Today is Thursday, August 17th, 2023. This is part 15 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing really good.
Good.
Beautiful day here.
Super. Good to hear it. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Alan, in the end, toward the end of the last interview, you were talking about a hike you did by yourself to Rainbow Bridge in 1963. Would you please tell us more about the hiking that you did in Glen Canyon?
Okay, I don't know how to really present that. First, I'll explain for the first about 10 years there was a lot of hiking just with people that I worked with at school and knew from church, and we'd go out and plan a trip. And then in later years, when I was working for the Park Service, and I got to do a lot of hiking, which was great. I think the part that start with a couple of the hikes and see if that's what you're looking for.
Okay.
One of my favorite hikes from Page was down into Navajo Canyon and Shoal Canyon. You drive east of Page a few miles and out on the end of the reservation and across the flats there to the rim of Shoal Canyon. And then that's probably 2 or 3 miles down to Shoal Creek, which is just a marvelous, marvelous place for about 2 or 3 miles. Wonderful campsites, nice stream, several springs. And not towering cliffs, but cliffs on all sides. And you get in and out where this fault line, you know, gives a break if they could make a trail down there in the old days. And Shoal Canyon is the one that comes from Kaibato, and you cross on 69 going east on the reservation with that creek going down. And there's several major petroglyph sites along the creek. It's riparian delight. It's just
wow. The
epitome of what a...
Is that spelled C-H-O-L? How do you spell Chol?
Chol. C-H-O-A-L, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Like Chol, but Chol. And it has several different names.
Okay.
Like I say, it's Kaibato Creek, and then it comes in. It joins Navajo Canyon maybe 3 or 4 miles downstream from where we would come in. And one of the main attractions was the Chol Falls, which was when we first started, it was maybe 2 miles from the lake level in Chol Canyon and Navajo Canyon, and then as the lake rose, it actually went underwater for a year there, and then came out and washed away, came back to what it was. It's a very beautiful falls. Gary Ladd has taken many, many pictures down in there of the falls, hiking and going by boat, and it's like, especially with the red rock and when the cottonwood trees turn yellow and then the stream It's a great place. We have several hikes with friends of ours. Well, I'm trying to think of what his name was because he moved away many, many years ago, but he really enjoyed exploring, hiking. And the other thing that happens there, Shoal and Navajo Canyons, is where the original the Spanish Trail from Escalante Trail, Dominguez Escalante, when they came through, crossed at the Crossing of the Fathers, went east and a little south and crossed Navajo Canyon there at Shoal.
Okay.
And then climbed out on the plateau again and headed for the Hopi villages. And I've always been positive there was a very obvious major Indian trail there that, or at least everyone knew about it.
Okay.
That they visited with. And in later years, there were a couple rumors of Spanish from Santa Fe that loaded up pack mules of what they thought would be valuable in California and headed west, following the Dominguez Escalante route, and kind of improving upon it. But that trail, where it comes down onto Navajo and up out of Chol, it was rebuilt by the CCC. There was a CCC camp down in there somewhere. And they improved the trail, but it doesn't really go anywhere. And you can't get to it from anywhere. But it's there. If you go up by boat, you could definitely see the trail work from the CCC.
Okay.
And it identifies, obviously, what they considered the Escalante, Dominguez Escalante route. So,
Alan, I wanted to ask you about Upper Chol, because I hadn't connected. The names are a little befuddling to me. But you mentioned Caibito, and Caibito has some stunning narrows in it.
Right.
Of course, there's lots of Glen Canyon that has stunning narrows in it. Did you get up into the Caibito narrows part of Chol?
Well, yes and no, just to the hint of the lower end, because when you go from the area we hiked into, most of the time we'd walk up maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles, and there was a pour over that was, you couldn't get by.
Got it.
At least without our climbing gear or hiking way up around on the top and coming down again. And you were there, you were in the start of the, or the end of the Caibito Narrows.
Okay.
Now, the whole thing about this, it was a very popular, well, just among the real backpacking crew, and also from the lake, thousands of people walked up to the Chol Falls.
Oh, okay.
Just a mile or so. And the problem is, up on top, the way we came in from Highway, I guess, I don't know what the number is, that goes from Page to Caibito and on, but the native people out there became very hostile to hikers, especially, and because a bunch of them were very rude.
Yeah.
And not understanding culture and asking permission and talking. And we finally went in, made sure we had a local Navajo with us when we went in.
Nice.
Even took the Boy Scouts the Cub Scouts in for an overnight, and what we did. And then it was the area, as far as I know, access from the rims is basically closed now.
Right.
And I know that Upper Kaibato Narrows was closed very early.
Mm-hmm.
The tribal or the Kaibato Council were definitely closed it, so I always regretted that because it's such a beautiful place and beautiful canyon. But in there at the mouth of, well, we hiked down Shoal to Navajo Canyon, and if it was the time of year when you could walk across Navajo Creek, you know, without getting too wet,
mm-hmm.
because it was right near the top of the lake at whatever time you were going there. And across there on the cliff, and behind the row of cottonwoods and tamarisk, there was one of the best petroglyph panels in Lake Powell. They're just magnificent. And over the years, as the Navajo Creek is very active and moving a lot of sand down with every storm.
Okay.
And building a delta there. And when I went back several years later, only about half the petroglyphs were above the sand. So it was just that's what happens.
Right.
The low levels for a while, maybe the creek washes that area out and drops the washes the sand, and then in most areas that protects the petroglyphs, so maybe it's a good thing in the end. But,
well, it's another.
As far as the first few years in Page, that's what I remember more than anything. And then the time, you know, I talked about teaching the class and the geology and several other classes on the area and having outings. And we went, like I mentioned, up Navajo Mountain Camp on top.
Mm-hmm.
And another time we went, the class went to Rainbow Ridge and then walked down, and friends and relatives met us with boats and took us home. But the other thing now, I'll move ahead, but we'll tie this all together, is that trying to think of dates, but it was in the mid or late, it was probably 95 or 6, 96 at that.
Did you tell me about
that? Yeah, I did.
Oh, okay.
All right. Because, see, in 94, I got my first bout of lymphoma and was pretty well demolished in many ways, but hiking part of it. And I had, you know, several months of chemo, survived it. I taught through part of it, but it kind of limited my it limited what I could do for a couple of years. But
I bet.
In 96, the park had a real problem in Lake Powell, and a good friend of mine and Ada Hatch, too, was Stephanie Dubois, who was the assistant and chief interpreter and then the chief interpreter for the recreation area. And the issue was that the state of Utah requested that at the park make water sample tests to just certify that the water was potable, drinkable.
Okay.
In Lake Powell, and ended up with a fellow who was a real good friend of ours that was in charge of the water and the water quality. Unfortunately, as they started making tests up the lake, they found major pollution in the lake, so much so that the park recommended and the state approved and closed many of the side canyons to visitation.
Wow.
And this water is polluted.
What kind of pollution? What were they finding?
E. coli.
Oh.
Is what they would test for. And it was human. And the park, of course, immediately went out to find out what's going on. And the fact that if you went up in any of the side canyons from Waweep, all up the whole lake, any campsite, you walk 50 yards back from the campsite in any little bush, and there was great piles of human waste.
Got it.
And what they didn't realize was when you went out in the spring and did that, by July, all of that was going to be underwater.
Oh, wow.
And it was.
Okay.
And the, it was a great crisis, appropriately, because the numbers were just staggering. And the park went on they had to come up with some way, and part of it was re-educating the public on what you had to do with your waste, and they made it mandatory that anyone camping anywhere around the lake had to have a porta potty, a portable toilet.
Yeah.
And considering the houseboats had toilets, big cruisers had toilets, but we had to make sure they weren't just dumping it in the lake.
Mm.
But so there was the requirement that you had to have a portable toilet and use it. And then the park, actually the concessionaire, as part of their contract, they built several floating toilets on the lake.
Okay.
Where if you were out during the day, or even if you were camped over there, you could take your porta potty out there and dump it. And the concessionaire had a crew that came around once or twice a week and cleaned out that as regular day use. People were encouraged, and that was very popular. It actually worked. The other thing was that the interpretation was given the job and took the job to educate the boating public. And the way it came out was, I was in charge of the southern half of the lake. Another lady was worked out of Bullfrog and was in charge of the upper part. And it developed to where I had a bonus. What, pardon?
I'm sorry, I just coughed.
Oh, that's okay. I had a park boat assigned to me.
Okay.
And I was assigned to water quality, and had either law enforcement rangers or other interpretive rangers who would come out with me. And the idea was to go from camp to camp and to be very friendly, educational only the first 2 years of, do you have a porta potty? If you don't, please get one. Please use it. And, you know, that worked. That was also a, it turned out I didn't know, but in the end, my dream job, because I would, and whoever was assigned to go with me, I'd go out for 4 to 5 days, 4 nights, camping on the lake. And every, we'd technically put in 8 hours visiting with people and checking it and making sure and keeping records and maps. But then I always made sure that we camped up one of the side canyons in a different side canyon each time. And we'd be there at like 4 o'clock and it didn't get dark till 8
right.
or 9. And so I could get in several miles of hiking up the side canyons
nice.
Every day. And I did. I mean, this was not part of my job description. Everyone knew what I did.
Right.
Especially because all the guys would come back just unbelievably awed by how beautiful the canyons were and learning them. So, and I did that for 4 years, I think.
Nice.
I ended up with a big, beautiful cruiser with pontoons on the side that made it easier to dock with people and through the side canyons. And it had twin 250 four-strokes, which was, I had no boating experience before, but I became a really expert boater for Lake Powell and how to get around safely and land and negotiate in very narrow, very shallow, rocky, all that stuff.
And there's wind. I mean, the wind can make waves, and that's just wicked up there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had many, many a day when we'd have a storm come and straight-line winds and horrendous waves, and knowing where to get into a side canyon that was protected.
Right.
And then several times I would just putter around in low gear in a circle in the little dead-end canyon under an alcove, and because the wind was so strong, I really couldn't tie up to the shore anywhere that I considered safe. But
I right.
had several 15, 20 major, major storms come through out there, which I was pretty proud about the fact that I would readily just turn around and go back, and there's no reason to go through that.
Right.
Line of lightning and thunder and huge waves.
Yep.
And take up the next day. So when you can use, Karen was just asking, you can use that stuff. Just go and there's a place where you can use it without having an account. Okay. And it was, our district was technically anywhere from all in the Rock South, but I extended it to include the whole of the Escalante Canyon, because the lady up north has rarely got down there, and I just let it be known that I'd do her a favor and spend a few weeks in the Escalante.
Oh, tough for you. Uh-huh.
Yes, right.
Lovely. Yes. Very nice. Yeah.
All right, so when you ask about my hiking in Glen Canyon, I'm not, you know, it sounds bad for me to say it, but I literally have hiked up virtually every canyon from the Escalante downstream.
Nice.
Some of them extensively, others superficially, just getting a feel for, you know, how much far you can get in an hour or 2 hours in an afternoon. But that included going up to San Juan and all the canyons coming off Navajo Mountain. Every one of them is fantastic. I have vivid memories of virtually every canyon.
Wow.
And, you know, the job I had, most people, especially the law enforcement, they just hated it. Just the fact that we were going to go and check if people have porta potties, and if they were, you know, harassed and kidded by their peers, the other rangers, by going on porta potty patrol. And,
right.
They were all, just going out on the lake that much was a real imposition, because they were highway cops.
Oh, wow.
And all have cruisers, all couldn't wait to get back. Most of them, the last day, I finally gave in and would get back to Waweep afternoon, early in the afternoon, because within 20 minutes of landing, the guy would be calling on to the dispatch in his cruiser for the afternoon's normal work. So,
huh.
The other thing was that Joe Alston was the superintendent.
Okay.
I knew him because his wife taught in the elementary with me. I've known her for years and have met him since.
That's Judy.
Yeah. And she just taught down the halls.
Okay.
And I'd see her every day. And I knew him, and he'd come to school activities. And then Stephanie DeVoe was the person he gave, you know, the responsibility to make sure that this program was successful, contacting people.
Okay.
I think he knew the rangers, the law enforcement, it would be difficult. But when the guys went out with me, you know, for 4 or 5 days, they all came back just having had an unbelievable experience.
Wow.
And I found that even though they were all technically boat certified, where they could legally take out the ranger boat and go on a search and rescue or a medical issue or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or at least help the more experienced rangers or the younger ones, they really had no experience on the lake, where to go, what to expect when you get there.
Right.
And they had a map, and some of them had memorized all the side canyons, but they had no picture in their mind what was there.
Okay.
And one of my goals was to educate them into, you know, that after their week, they were all proficient in going out on the lake and doing what their job was, but Joe Alston, he really wanted that to be programmed to be successful.
Nice.
And it was an issue, which in the end I just said to the law enforcement tough business guys, because Every time I went into headquarters to report to Stephanie, if Joe saw me or out on the parking lot, he'd come right over and he'd ask, "How's it going?" And he didn't want a, "Oh, it's me." He wanted details. Who did I go with? How successful it was? How many camps did you see? What were the problems? How could we change it? How could we improve it? Is it successful? You know, and I got used to that and became good friends with him, really, because he was so open and so serious and so supportive.
Nice.
He really wanted this to be successful and have the lake good water again, because when you're out on the lake, the water is beautiful. It's just, you know, that clear, clear water. And so it was 4 or 5 years that I worked on that. And we made a very big impact on the campers.
Okay.
And at the time, most of them, probably half, were coming from Flagstaff. And the other half from Kanab in southern Utah, for a weekend camping trip out on the lake. They'd come in Friday, go set up camp, and then fish or tour around and camp Sunday, Saturday night, and then Sunday when afternoon they'd come in and go back home.
Okay.
So, and we actually got it down to what it today seems normal, but at the time it was all very newest technology and all. I was permitted to take a laptop with me.
Wow.
In the park. Cartographer, the map guy who was very good with computers, set up a mapping program.
Oh, wow.
Where I could bring up on the screen, you know, anywhere that I was. If there was a side canyon I was going in, there was the topo map of the land around and the land under the lake.
Wow. Okay.
Huh.
And
then I would, or we would visit a camp, and, you know, either yes, they had it, yes, they were using it, or no, they didn't, and no, please go and get one. But I'd keep the stats on the computer of that. It would mark the spot on the map, and we had a code, like I'd set up to describe the camp, you know, blue tent with a white awning, something that actually worked, three boats, you know, jet ski, whatever. And then yes, they did, how many people, or no, they did not. And so at the end of the day, the program would generate a report for me, listing every camp that I visited and the stats and the totals. And on some long weekends, when there were a lot of people and I had someone who really worked with me,
mm-hmm.
I could visit 400 camps over the weekend.
Wow.
And we could see over the progress of the summer, people with porta potties and using them, the percentage went up and up and up.
Oh, wow, cool.
Which was wonderful. You know, it just, and it got to the point where I recognized probably half the people, because Glen Canyon has the largest repeat visitation of any park area in the country.
Huh.
And the people that you know, there were families that came every other week all summer long. So they would come, you know, easily 8 or 10 times and bring other friends or just be themselves. They'd either go to the same camp or try something new. And they got to the place where the group would be sitting in their lawn chairs and waiting for me to beach the boat and get off and come up, and they'd all laugh, and they'd point to their friends. That was their first trip, and they'd say, "See, I told you he was coming. I told you we had to put the potty out because the ranger will be here."
Uh-huh.
And that felt really good. You know?
Cool.
It was just a lot of stuff, and I could tell them about things to do. Have you been up this canyon? Have you seen the arch there?
Oh, neat.
The arrows there. You know, and they would tell me what they had been to and all. So that was really good. In the end, the last year, it became decided that we'd have to start issuing citations to people who didn't have one or didn't use it and obviously had been using the bushes, and I couldn't, but the other law enforcement rangers did. And that whole thing left kind of a bitter taste.
Yeah.
The way I was, because there were times there where I'd find a camp that was not in compliance, and I'd have to go out and call the district ranger and say, "There's this camp at such and such a place," and the ranger would, if he was on the water, would go out there and check them out and write them a ticket. And that that wasn't my thing.
Alan, if you were superintendent of the recreation area, what would you have done? How would you have handled that? Because you do want compliance.
Yeah.
You know, the place, as you say, has a ton of visitation, lots of repeat users, and can be loved to death, as you mentioned, with the E. coli concentrations in the water.
Well, one thing to remember is by the third summer, there were no bad E. coli tests.
Oh, wow, cool.
So, and the ones that were found were places where there was heavy grazing cattle.
Oh.
And the cattle were standing under a shady tree right at the, you know, they drank water at the lake, and then when the lake came up, all cow poop was under there. And,
yeah.
But that was very localized and dealt with. It was the places that were human. That the water really improved, and it was a great success in that sense.
Right.
But what you're saying is true. There was the whole deal with law enforcement, rangers. I had seen the whole history of it when I, way back when I started talking to you about growing up in Yosemite, the park rangers, there weren't law enforcement, there were not interpreters, they were just rangers.
Right.
They didn't carry guns. They were out to inform people and give, direct them to doing the right thing. In some park areas, like in Zion, the park rangers, if there was a criminal case, they had to call the county sheriff.
Right.
And so, you know, but then in, I don't know if it would be the 80s, 90s, there were the law enforcement division came up. In fact, I probably mentioned before when I was in high school or college in California when Yosemite bought its first cruiser, law enforcement cruiser,
right,
cop car, that was over all the newspapers. That's all anyone could talk about in the outdoor, community, the Sierra Club, everything. And not because the park did it, it was because the criminals were coming to the park. So it had to be something like that. But then the law enforcement rangers now, they're typically they go to a 4-year program. NAU in Flagstaff has a ranger law enforcement degree.
Right.
And then they're probably junior year, senior, they get a seasonal at different parks in the area. And when they're hired, after they graduate, they work for a couple years to make sure that this person's going to be what they want. And then they're sent to the law enforcement academy in Georgia.
Yep.
I guess it is. It's the FBI academy. And they come out of that as official federal law enforcement officers.
Right.
The part that bugged me was, okay, you've got these rangers well trained and all, but the Department of Interior or anyone can send them to anywhere they need federal law enforcement, to the Texas border, to the anywhere in the country where there's federal issues. Park rangers are technically trained to do that. And when they now they have a different badge, very different than the rest of the staff of the interpretive rangers that have the flat hat and the visitor contacts with. And they are dealing with a whole set of law enforcement, of federal laws,
right,
that have been passed for the parks. And the federal judge from Flagstaff came up to Long Lake once a month and held court there.
Oh, okay.
And and there was reason to. It would be a busy day of all these people accused and making the cases and hopefully getting some conviction. But the law enforcement, they really present themselves differently. They really enjoy dressing up like a SWAT team, but it's not the old rangers. And there's a real division that the public wouldn't realize between the law enforcement and interpretation and administration. They really, there was actually a push to a proposal to have all the law enforcement rangers in all the parks under the region. In other words, the chain of command would bypass the superintendent and go, they would be an independent law enforcement operation. Fortunately, that was shot down, but when you ask, Joe Alston did a great job. He really pressured the rangers, the district rangers, to support what they were doing out there.
Okay.
They begrudgingly did. And that's I don't know what he could have done differently, because he was very aware of these issues that were not obviously to the public or a problem with the program. It was just who was, having to do it.
Right. Well, it's such a complicated issue, and it's not unique to Glen Canyon, where you want to have contact with the public. You want that contact to be friendly and educational.
Yeah.
But as soon as there's law enforcement involved, it changes. Everything changes. It can change, depending on the training of the officer and depending on the recreational visitor.
Right.
And so what's the Park Service to do? And as you mentioned, there's a lot of people in law enforcement that want to be Chevy Rangers, and drive in their patrol cars and move on to the next job.
Yeah.
How would you, now looking back on this, how would you propose it should be done?
Well, I really, at the moment here, I don't know, because, I and my peers there, we really discussed it a lot. But we couldn't see any way to, it was much bigger than our issue there. And I see, the case like, at Yellowstone, where people go, and won't leave the buffalo alone, the bison.
Right.
And are getting injured by it.
Right.
The interpreters can have every program they want on bison and including recommendations for how to behave around them.
Right.
But a lot of the public doesn't go to the museum. They don't go to the evening programs. They are out there getting out of their car and doing stupid things and getting hurt.
Right.
But the rangers can't sit out there. I'm sure they do sometimes when there's a herd of buffalo right by the pavement. They'd have to just sit there and walk up and down telling people to get in their car.
Right. It's a really good point, where interpretation can only educate so far, and people can miss that education and then hurt the resource or get hurt by the resource.
Yeah. Because the Grand Canyon, South Rim is obvious, where you used to have busloads of Asian tourists, China or Japan or Korea, and most of them, I don't know, I can't say because you wouldn't have seen the numbers, but a lot of them, not reading English well or not listening, and the ones that I did have contact with down at like Navajo Bridge and in the visitor centers, many people would come in and for all intents and purposes would not or could not speak English.
Okay.
And how can you really get anything across to these people?
Right.
You try to make signs in all the languages, but that's kind of silly too. It's a major issue. And we faced it there, the program that I thought was really good, Joe thought it was really good, Stephanie and all my bosses, but, we had the fight on I will say that every one of the rangers that came out with me on the lake did a very professional job.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody backed off and just pouted.
But I guess I'm thinking that your ability to make contact with visitors who would come to the resource every other week, have a unique potential there to make friends with these people, to make them advocates for the resource.
Well, exactly.
And I think there's merit to that. There's a lot of good benefit to that.
Right. Right. So, what I was going to say. I have to think a little now. My mind is going in several directions.
Well, we were talking about just, the busloads of tourists that may not speak English,
yeah.
that may not understand the resource protection method, message.
Right.
If that message is not distributed in 20 different languages, which some of the resource messages are, which is good.
Right.
And then how different parks have different visitation types. Clearly, if you've got people who are going to come week after week, and they're going to buy a boat, which is a big investment, dragging that boat to the resource and then putting it on the water. Making sure it doesn't sink because the drain plugs, aren't put in.
Yeah.
There's a learning curve
right.
there. That's a, those people can become resources to help protect
right.
the resource. At least I like to think so. Maybe I'm naive.
Right. Well, initially, the first couple of years when, I'd have coming repeats, and they'd often say, we hiked up over that canyon over there, and there's a bunch of poop in there, And that was the other side to it that I haven't mentioned to you yet, was the fact that, it was when we were still teaching, Sharon and I, figured out a neat way our kids were going to college, and we both were working for the park, but we had to quit early to get back to school for the season went on another month or so.
Right.
And what we convinced them is let us we'll come out there on Friday night, take the boat, and go out and meet people on Saturday and Saturday night, and come back, and we'd just camp in the boat for the night or two nights. And one of the things that, as the season progressed, we found we were, the campers all but disappeared after Labor Day, especially after school started and flag and cab and all. But there was a thing I didn't mind. When I went out there and found a tree with a bunch of dried poop around it, I just didn't mind having a sack and a shovel and just get it up. Because, I couldn't walk away from it because
right.
The water was coming, The lake was right there, and here's this old stuff. So I'd scoop it up and take it out to the floating toilet out there and dump it.
Right.
But then we went to where the whole point of our going out most weekends was to do cleanup, which
right.
meant picking up trash as the lake went down, and cleaning up the human waste that was still there.
That's,
and it also showed me graphically that we have a lot more education to do.
Right. It's not just solid waste, but trash, aluminum cans, anchors, folding chairs, umbrellas. I mean, it goes on and on. The amount and boats and you know whatnot that have you know inadvertently people have lost that stuff. There's a huge amount of trash at these various different levels of
So we were able to take out the boat, which was a little cabin cruiser, and we enjoyed very much going out for at least 8 weekends in the fall, and then we'd start again in spring where we could finish off our, because as in temporary seasonal interpreters, we could only work 6 months.
Right.
And so they were glad to pay us to go out and do that, and we really enjoyed it.
Nice.
And hiked and hiked and hiked and cleaned up and cleaned up. And so when your initial question of how much I hiked Glen Canyon for,
yeah. Did you in your hiking, and we probably want to, you know, think about drawing this interview to a close now. Your hiking, your patrol area was Escalante West or Southwest, if you will.
Yeah.
Did you spend time above Bullfrog, up around the Horn and Old Height, and up in that country?
No.
Okay.
There was another ranger up there.
Okay.
That had the same position I did. Did it a little differently, but I just did what I want, was successful and did a good program. So I didn't spend much time at all north of Escalante.
Okay. All right.
I love the Escalante.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, you definitely were in some incredibly beautiful country.
Right.
And I'm curious, did you ever seek out any photographs of Glen Canyon before the reservoir and do any photo rematching with that?
I thought of that. There were some either magazine articles, or I think there's at least one or two books that someone tried to do that reasonably successfully. But I never did it. I did find, you know, a lot of pictures. The park had a lot of pictures of before the dam, and I enjoyed those because I knew what it looked like now, but I never did a photo comparison.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe this is a good point here to put a comma in this interview series.
Mm-hmm.
And we will pick this up again at a later date. Does that sound like a plan?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then let's conclude part 15 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Thursday, August 17th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.